next hear oral argument in the appeal of Roger Endicott versus the United States and Charles Kaiser. Mr. Connell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Archer and Griner by John C. Connell on behalf of Defendant Kaiser.
Sorry for mispronouncing your name.
No, I just
the accent on the.
I do it for the record consulate, so it's clear in the transcript. Otherwise, I get all sorts of variations. So.
Thank you for that.
And may I reserve 3 minutes for.
Right.
There may be situations in which a government official's speech can give rise to a claim of unconstitutional retaliatory arrest and prosecution. But in the circumstances presented here, that being airport security, no such right should be implied and certainly was not recognized as clearly established on January 26, 2013,
well,
the date
say,
of this incident.
What is it you're saying wasn't clearly established? What is it? In your briefing, you seem to say that what wasn't clearly established was a private right of action under Bivens. If that's your position, what do we make of Supreme Court language that talks about the right being clearly established, not causes of action, not specific claims, but a right being established?
Well, in Hartman, the court clearly said that probable cause was a necessary element of a retaliatory prosecution claim, but it did not address whether or not there was a remedy under Bivens and whether Bivens extended to the First Amendment.
Sure, but the right being spoken about is the right to free expression without government actors retaliating, right? I guess the challenge here is, right, there's a ladder of abstraction. You seem to want to say, you have to be perfectly concrete in talking about the cause of action. There are some cases that I would like you to address that talk about this in terms of you have a right to be free of retaliation by government actors for the things that you say. What's your response to that?
In this particular case, that again being airport security, the court has never extended Bivens to that First Amendment protection. The only case that existed at the time of this incident was a Rendon case in which the passenger asserted a First Amendment right, and the court said, no, that it doesn't apply here. And in fact, the court upheld the facial challenge to that regulation under the First Amendment.
What about our patent case? Okay, patent goes back a good ways, back to 1975. But we said that we believed the extension of the Bivens rule to violations of First Amendment rights to be both justifiable and logical. In other words, if you've got a First Amendment retaliation claim,
right,
a problem, a Bivens action will lie.
The problem with the patent case, Your Honor, is that it applied to only an unconstitutional interception by the government. That's an entirely different situation than a retaliatory arrest and prosecution, which is the case here.
Why is it entirely different?
I just wanted to add, and in the wake of Hartman, Iqbal and Reichel both said that Bivens will not be extended to the First Amendment. So all I'm saying, Your Honor, is that under the circumstances that exist, under the law that existed at the time, there was no notice to Mr. Kaiser that his conduct would have resulted in a First Amendment violation.
Are you saying that Hartman and Iqbal overruled Patton?
I'm saying they certainly called it into question. To the extent that they left the law unclear as to what the right was that was supposed to be clearly established under Hartman.
So you think that a reasonable TSA officer could operate under the impression that it's okay for him to get upset with what somebody says and therefore to retaliate make something up to get back at them. You're thinking that's something that a reasonable TSA officer could have thought was within bounds of the law.
Well, what I'm saying is...
That's just a straight-up question. Is that because what you're saying is it couldn't have been, you know, it was a foggy area. So your assertion is a reasonable TSA officer could think, I'm upset with that, I'm getting back at that person, and I can do it because of what they said. That was within the realm of the reasonable appreciation of what a TSA agent could do.
I will say that that right was not clearly established at the time of this incident, correct?
Let me back you up. I should have really raised this at the outset for clarity. And it goes to the weighting of qualified immunity here, because we have the two claims in this case, right? The First Amendment
and the Fourth
claim and the Fourth Amendment
right.
claim.
Correct, Your Honor.
My understanding of what you sought here was summary judgment as to the First Amendment claim, but I don't know that I saw you seeking that for the Fourth Amendment claim, nor did the district court opinion address that. What I want to do is simply clarify from both sides that there's no jurisdictional problem here with respect to our determination of both, that in fact we do have both before us.
Understood, and I think this was an issue that we did raise in our briefing before the court.
I think in response to a question, if I recall. But,
I think our position about this is, having raised the qualified immunity defense, it would apply, obviously, to both claims of constitutional violations, First Amendment and Fourth Amendment.
But interestingly, and I went back and reread the district court opinion, there's never even a reference to the Fourth Amendment claim in that opinion. It's all directed at the First Amendment. But in any event, following up then on Judge Jordan's questions, assuming that Bivens does extend to a First Amendment claim here, what does a plaintiff in these circumstances need to do by sufficiently invoking his First Amendment rights for purposes of then saying, well, you retaliated against me for my having stated or done this? Because I understand the record here to be only that it is alleged that Mr. Vanderklok said or requested was to be able to make some kind of complaint or report. Is that what the record shows?
He did insist that he was going to make a report, and he wanted to know how to do it. I believe the videotape shows that some of his conduct at the scene was somewhat disruptive as well. It was not disruptive, perhaps, to the extent in Rendon, where they had to close down the line of the passengers coming through the security screening, but that is what the record shows.
I do have a question, if I might follow up. I'm a little worried about jurisdiction here, because I read the same things that the chief judge did, read the section of your briefing below that begins on page 19 of docket item 69-2, talks all about the malicious prosecution claim under the Fourth Amendment must be dismissed with prejudice, not a peep about qualified immunity. How can we have jurisdiction to deal with an issue that wasn't discussed at all in the district court?
Well, as I said before, I believe that impliedly it was a part of the qualified immunity argument generally that we asserted before the district court, intending to be applied to both the First and Fourth Amendment claims.
Gotcha.
And then we also made the argument in our papers as well that even if there was some argument for waiver, we would call upon the court's discretion to exercise, you know, judicial administration over this issue, because it's important for the public to understand these issues.
I'm sure it's absolutely important. The question is, do we get to expand our jurisdiction because things are important?
In a case of this sensitivity, I would think that would be critically important, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. All due respect. No. Any further questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Cannell. Mr. Aguilar? on behalf of the United States, arguing as amicus.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. We're here arguing that the Court should not extend a Bivens cause of action in this remedy under the second prong of the Wilkie v. Robbins test, which is that there are significant special factors that counsel against the recognition of a new kind of federal litigation.
Mr. Aguilar, I got to say I was surprised to see an amicus about Bivens in the First Amendment in the Third Circuit that didn't mention Patton, Milhouse, where we said that Bivens will apply in a First Amendment context. Do you want to tell us why we shouldn't be paying attention to our own precedent in that regard?
Sure. So we've noted that this Court has said that Bivens applies in a First Amendment retaliation context, most recently in the Mack case. We've noted that the Supreme Court has had some language cautioning that approach, but obviously that's precedent that it binds this panel. But that doesn't speak to the issue of whether or not Bivens applies in any and all contexts. And as the Supreme Court explained in Wilkie, when extending Bivens into a new context, here, the screening area of an airport where TSA screening agents conduct that screening and then communicate any perceived potential threats to law enforcement officers, that gives rise to
the logic of Patton is, and it's pretty clear, it says, were there no cause of action for federal infringement of First Amendment rights, an aggrieved individual could seek damages for violations of his First Amendment rights by state officials, citing Section 1983, but not federal officials. There is no reason to allow federal officials to act with impunity in this context and to bar state officials. That's from page 870 of the Patton case. In this instance, nobody could come into court should Mr. Vandercock have decided to sue the state officials, that is, the police officers, and say, hey, wait a second, under 1983, there's no cause of action. Now, maybe they'd have some 12b6 reason why it should fail, but there'd be a 1983 cause of action, right?
Correct.
Okay. So Patton says it doesn't make any sense to say the fellow with the uniform right here that's got the federal badge and the fellow with the state uniform on right here that's got the state badge should be treated differently. There's no logic to that. It's not fair. There's no reason the cops should be on the hook and the federal agent shouldn't. What is wrong with that reasoning from Patton? What has been said by any court since then to undermine that logic?
Sure. So as the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, 1983 actions are a vehicle created by Congress to vindicate that right and impose personal damages on state officers. If that statute did not exist, a court would have to imply a cause of remedy. And as the Supreme Court has said in the Malesko case, I believe most recently, implied causes of action under the Constitution are disfavored. Now, Bivens represents the first time the Supreme Court decided to imply that cause of action, but as it has cautioned repeatedly since then, particularly in Wilkie, the court should consider in the first instance whether to extend it into a new context. And here, the special factors of the national security of the United States.
Let's get into that, Mr. Aguilar, because the time is always limited, and you've been permitted to argue as amicus, and what is, I think, unique to your purview than of the national security interests that are argued in your brief. And I think the panel would like to hear from you with respect to what those interests are and why they ought to override some of the other jurisprudential concerns that have been argued and expressed here.
Sure. So Congress created the TSA in the wake of the September 11th attacks, specifically to preserve the national security and defense of the United States. And it did that by creating TSA officers who are not law enforcement officers and who instead have a more specific and focused approach, which is to screen all passengers and baggage that board commercial aircraft in the United States, which is a tremendous volume, approximately 2 million passengers, 6 million pieces of baggage a day. And their duty in doing that is to identify any potential threats or suspicious behavior in order to prevent that from getting on the aircraft. As we know, on average, about 5 loaded firearms are found in carry-on baggage every day.
In fact, Mr. Kaiser, as a TSA agent, would have been perfectly within his rights to call the Philadelphia police here had there been no verbal exchange whatsoever between Mr. Vandercock and him.
Particularly when it wasn't determined whether this device had any explosives with it and there was a great deal of suspicion about what this was.
Wait a minute. Well, I think you may be making things more difficult for yourself. Let's say after it was determined that there was no explosive involved in this device.
What we're arguing is that TSA agents generally have very broad latitude to relay any concerns to police officers.
So will you answer my question? Wouldn't Mr. Kaiser have been perfectly within the realm of his responsibilities to have contacted the Philadelphia police, even after it was determined this was not an explosive device, but given its inherently suspicious nature?
Sure, as long as there maintains...
It's a difficult question. People test these systems all the time.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's why the political branches are best equipped to determine whether there should be a personal cause of action at all because of the great national security interests at stake.
The concept, probable cause, pops up within the briefing here and there, and I'm wondering, given the non-law enforcement nature of a TSA agent, what threshold the law requires before an agent may, as Mr. Kaiser did here, alert the police to conduct further investigation. In fact, I shouldn't say further investigation, to conduct some investigation, because beyond screening itself, he's also not an investigative officer.
Correct, Your Honor. The threshold is quite low because TSA officials are not trained in reasonable suspicion and probable cause. The point of the referral is when there is anything that is potentially disruptive, threatening, suspicious, that they can make that referral.
Would the PC pipe here be threatening and suspicious?
I believe
at the point that they might call the police in to look into it.
Again, particularly at the outset when it's undetermined what this is, I agree that it's particularly suspicious. My point is that we're not making an argument based on these facts. We're making an argument much broader based on the duties that TSA agents have.
We're dealing with the specific facts before us.
Correct.
If I should get a job with TSA because I decide judicial salary is too low...
Don't leave yet, Judge Rod.
And I find someone with a PVC pipe in his baggage with some electronic wires. Am I justified in calling in the police to have them help me investigate this?
So, if I may, I think that question probably goes to, in that specific factual context, to qualify...
Mr. Aguilar, recognize a softball when you see one.
I understand, but I'm just trying to make clear the broad scope of our argument here, is that regardless of those facts, any communications that are made in the security screening area from TSA agents to law enforcement officers need to be protected against the threat of personal damages liability because that can cause...
Any communication. So your assertion is, take the facts as pled as being true, okay?
Sure.
That this was a complete fabrication. You know, you take it out of this case. If you're uncomfortable working in this case, imagine a case in which a TSA agent says, I don't like the look of that person, or that person said something to me. Better yet, I don't like the way that person spoke to me. You know, I'm calling the cops and saying, this guy just threatened 15 passengers to me. He said, I'm going to shoot people, or I got a bomb. That there's nothing a TSA agent can say or do that puts him at risk because the TSA screening is so sensitive, TSA agents really can act with impunity. That seems to be what you're driving at.
So if I can, the Ninth Circuit had a similar allegation in their case, Mermetti versus United States, where the plaintiffs alleged an intentional falsehood in immigration proceedings that resulted in the plaintiff's revocation bond and detention for several years. And so there the Ninth Circuit had to determine, okay, what is the Bivens context for this case? And it's we look at whether the repeatable factual and legal scenarios.
Am I hearing yes?
Yes.
Your position is there's not a thing that a TSA agent can do, no matter how extraordinary or extreme, that would contravene anybody's constitutional rights at a level where there would be a remedy.
So obviously there
are... A remedy.
A personal damages remedy.
Any remedy.
So there are alternative remedies here.
That's what you should speak to, right? Because in this instance, the United States substituted itself
for Mr. Keiss or for others, and it took the state remedies off the table, didn't it?
Yes, because he was acting within his scope.
Right. So there weren't state remedies, and then the United States, after it did that, took the position that there's no federal tort claims remedy because he's not a law enforcement officer, so it took that remedy off the table, right? Took the state remedies off, took the Federal Tort Claims Act remedies off, and then it says, and there's no Bivens remedy because TSA is so special and you can't extend it to that. So it took it's trying to take that off the table. So what's the remedy? Assume an outrageous TSA agent, mind-bogglingly bad and retaliatory, wicked man or woman. So you've taken all those things off the table. What's the remedy?
The remedy is within Congress's control.
So you're saying there's no remedy?
I'm saying that if there is to be a personal damages remedy here, Congress is in the best position to create that in the first instance. Because
so
they
are saying there's no remedy, right? As of today, for Mr. Vanderklok or for people like him, there's no remedy. That's your position.
If you're saying a personal damages remedy against a TSA employee for those kind of communications, then we are saying that you cannot recover under Bivens for that.
I'm not asking about Bivens. I've asked you for any other remedy. You took the state remedies away. You took the FTCA remedies away. Now you're saying take the Bivens remedy away. In all these Bivens cases, it seems like the Supreme Court's careful to say, well, you won't get a Bivens remedy, but you've got this other thing going for you. What can you point to? What other thing of any sort are you pointing to say, well, that's the remedy and that's good enough?
So, if I can, Wilkie differentiates the inquiry into remedy as distinct from the inquiry into whether there are special factors that counsel against the creation of remedy. So those are two distinct inquiries. Okay. And although we pointed to, as you know, these alternative remedies, that's not our argument. It really is based on special factors.
And at the end, though, I'm hearing you say, from the United States perspective, there's no remedy, and that's okay. Because Congress, if they wanted to, they could make a remedy. But as of now, no remedy, and that's okay. That's the legal position the United States of America is presenting as amicus, correct?
If Mr. Vanderklok wants to challenge the scope of whether or not Defendant Keiser is acting within the Westfall Act, he can still do that on an eventual appeal from a final judgment there. If he wants to challenge whether or not a TSA officer is a law enforcement officer for purposes of the FTCA claim, he can still challenge that from
but
final appeal.
You've already said those are off the table. I mean, the United States position, you're saying he can challenge those things. But this is just pretty simple. I mean, you can own up to the position or you can say, no, you're mistaken and tell me how I'm mistaken. But it's pretty clear that your position is, because the United States did this through the course of litigation, there's to be no state remedies because you substituted. There's to be no FTCA remedies because that's a position you took and you persuaded the court. And there is to be no Bivens remedy. So you're saying there's no remedy and that's okay. Because if Congress wanted to give a remedy for the most outrageous behavior, it could do it. But short of that, no remedy, right?
Correct, because
okay.
Bivens...
Good enough. I've got you.
The reason for that, if I can just explain,
yes. Go ahead.
Because I can understand why that is of some concern to the court, is because, as the Seventh Circuit noted in Vance versus Rumsfeld, the Bivens personal liability cause of action is a blunt instrument. And particularly within the context of national security, a civil Bivens action on a preponderance of the evidence standard can sometimes result in erroneous outcomes. And the politically accountable branches are in the best position to weigh the concerns of vindicating people's constitutional rights, providing a personal damages remedy, and securing the national security of the United States in a manner that is best attuned to all of those concerns. And that's why that decision ought to be left to Congress.
Thank you very much, Mr. Aguilar.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Malone?
And please, the Court. Your Honors, my name is Thomas Malone, and I'm here for Mr. Vanderklok, the appellee in this case.
Not everybody goes to a TSA station with a PVC pipe and a watch inside. It's a rather unusual choice to make.
This was the third or fourth time Mr. Vanderklok had done so.
Why is it that I'm not surprised to hear that?
Well, I'm not sure why it is that you're not surprised to hear that, but Mr. Vanderklok
would it be a little surprising to to think you go through screening with a pipe, PVC pipe with caps on both ends and electronics inside, and think it's not going to be a problem?
Problem is, I think, the word that I would like to address, because Mr. Vanderklok, having been on construction sites and having asked for something or made something himself to protect his heart monitoring watch, which is an item of expense, I'd submit to the court. This is on record, by the way. He was asked questions about this, and those questions are the basis of fact for which the district court has already ruled upon. He's been deposed on these. He's been asked questions from both sides. He did not have any idea what a pipe bomb looks like or that a PVC pipe was ever used ever in the history of the United States to make a pipe bomb.
So we're with you. It doesn't seem in retrospect, I'm sure Mr. Vanderklok would agree, in retrospect, maybe not such a great plan. But he did what he did, and that's not really where you're focused, right?
Correct.
Okay. You don't assert, do you, that the TSA agents have to have probable cause before they call police officers, do you?
I agree with the Chief Judge in that anybody in any situation can call the police. I mean, that is not a disputed. I could right now say that you've asked me and walk out of this courtroom.
So that's not what's at issue in this case, then, as far as you're concerned?
In terms of whether or not a person has the right to call the police, I agree that that is not an issue.
TSA agent or not?
Anybody has a right to call the police, I would submit, and I would agree with the court. However, in this situation, the impetus to calling police was the request after it was completely clear to everyone involved what was being traveled with was a heart monitoring watch and power bars. Nothing dangerous, nothing suspicious, nothing at all that could be construed.
Well, no, wait a minute. So, of course it's suspicious. Of course it's suspicious to a trained TSA agent. This may be someone who's trying to test the system. And for that reason, a TSA agent would be completely within the realm of his rightful responsibilities to summon law enforcement to conduct an investigation of some kind or even a brief inquiry that the TSA agent himself was not authorized to do.
Right. This is a new argument, one not made by the government in this case, but I agree with the court. So
it's really the combination of summoning the police and, in addition to that, providing the police with allegedly false information about what was said.
The impetus for the call in Mr. Vanderklok's position was to have him suffer. Was after they thought they had found something that was suspicious, it was suspicious to them, and I agree. And we've said throughout this. I'm sorry, Aaron?
It should have been.
Yes, suspicious. And I think we've said it in three or four or five different times throughout this proceeding that we have no problem and have never taken issue, and we would not be standing here because of the enhanced, let's look at the bag, let's run it through the machine again, let's delay. He had no problem with that. I have to at this point, if you could give me 2 seconds, to contradict something that counsel put on the record about the video, and I'm sure Your Honor have not watched it yet, and
we've read it. We've read about the cross examination and that there wasn't arm waving. You know, we know you don't agree with that.
There was no disturbance created at the airport whatsoever, according to every witness who testified in this case, in terms of the video itself and every piece of every deposition or evidence and police report in this case. There was not one moment where anything was disturbed at that airport checkpoint. Of course, the agents should be on alert. They should be looking at something like this in their training. It could be a pipe bomb, and they look, and that's what they did. He said, open it. It's just by running things. Open it. You can look inside. They did. It was a watch. And wires, there was a heart monitoring piece of the watch that went around the person's torso, which sends your heart rate to the watch that you wear on your wrist. But that's all that was in there. And then the subsequent discussion about organic materials, Mr. Vanderklok was confused by. He said, you can look anywhere in my bag. It's just by running things. He's thinking of plants and vegetation and fruits, vegetables.
Well, get to the heart of this, would you please, Mr. Malone? The heart of it is where the Chief Judge was taking a minute ago. It was a combination of this concern about the initial concern of the sure looks like a pipe bomb, and then what you allege, Mr. Vanderklok alleges to be false statements, a made-up story. Go ahead and deal, if you would, directly with what you're hearing from your opponents, which is, look, this is a very significant, highly sensitive national security thing we're talking about. People get used to walking in the airport and they think it's no big deal, but everybody's safety depends on this. If we have over-deterrence because you make people liable if they have a run-in with somebody, then you won't get what you need, which is careful, diligent, thoughtful, searching inquiry by TSA agents, because they'll be worried that the next Mr. Vanderklok who comes through with something that looks like a pipe bomb will come.
Right.
But that's what we're really dealing with here, right? I haven't said it as artfully as Mr. Aguilar, but that's what I understand the U.S. position to be, is you've got to butt out of this, because if you start meddling in it, you make everybody less safe. And if the price of that is that Mr. Vanderklok misses a half marathon and it goes to the expense of a criminal trial, that's more than unfortunate, but that's for Congress to deal with, not the court. That's what you need to speak to.
The issue of the safety of the airports is one that should concern us all. And obviously the Congress addressed that by creating TSA and creating TSA agents and officers. That does not change the fact that an airport is a public place and that people, United States citizens, have rights in that public place. They still have every right that they woke up with before they walked into the airport. Once they submit themselves to that screening, which Mr. Vanderklok did, once you behave appropriately, which Mr. Vanderklok did, give permission to search, which Mr. Vanderklok did, it should have been over. If there was an instance, wait, what's he doing? Is he testing the system? We would not be standing here. That's not what happened. This was not an enhanced, let's look into this, let's run him through the FBI system and see who he is. Let's make sure he's not just a 58-year-old architect with three kids who went to college, who works for Preet and has lived in Philadelphia since he moved here from Michigan with no incident with the law. Let's do all that. We wouldn't be standing here. The suit would have never been filed. What happened was something much more base, much more vile, and it really was nothing about airport security. The airport was secure the entire time he was there that day. The airport was secure after they put him in custody. It was secure because he had nothing dangerous, and it was secure because he behaved in an appropriate manner. What happened was Mr. Keyser got frustrated. Right. Abe Keyser got frustrated with his desire to file a complaint against him.
Now you're on the facts, which is great, but we're accepting your version of the facts.
Right.
For purposes of discussion and trying to get you to speak to the law, there's two legal things. There's the thing that Mr. Connell is saying on behalf of his client, which is, hey, this wasn't clearly established that a TSA agent couldn't call the police in and inform the police and let the police do an investigation. And Mr. Aguilar's point that there's no remedy here. Congress hasn't made a remedy, and the court isn't allowed to extend Bivens into this TSA screening area. Those are, facts aside, those are the things that I personally would very much like to have you address. I don't mean to
take
my colleague's time, but I would like to hear those.
Understood. It's a little bit awkward to address it to you because I sat and listened to your questions.
Just questions.
I know.
But I got these questions for you.
I would incorporate your questions back because those would, when I was sitting there, I was saying, well, Judge Jordan's saying what I was about to say, because it is absurd on its face to suggest that a citizen who wants to fly has to surrender their First Amendment rights when they walk into the airport. It is absolutely patently absurd to say that, and that 9/11 somehow created that.
Well, there's a plenty of Supreme Court decisions, and Mr. Aguilar cited them, where the Supreme Court says, you know, we've said Bivens has gone this far and is going no further. So before it gets extended to new areas and to new circumstances and to new parties, Congress is going to have to say something because we're not. I take that to be their position, that this is a new area.
In 1975, as Your Honor pointed out, Patton was decided. In 1981, the Third Circuit, this court, addressed and reaffirmed Patton in Milton versus Carlson. Milhouse versus Carlson. These are cases that are still precedent and are still binding precedent. There has never been a court to say, you know what, airports are such special places that we don't want to have the First Amendment apply, that we don't want to have Bivens apply. That case doesn't exist in the Third Circuit or in the Supreme Court. In fact, the District Court...
Is it undermined? Is that precedent undermined by Wilkie versus Robbins? Because that's what I'm hearing from your opponents, this is something that is... particularly, or as they said it in that case, in the absence of an alternative, a Bivens remedy is a
subject of judgment. The federal courts must make the kind of remedial determination, et cetera, and then goes on to say you've got to watch out for these special circumstances. You can't be just spreading it out. They seem to be implying that later Supreme Court precedent cuts back on Patton and Milhouse. Why are they wrong?
They're wrong because there have been subsequent cases that address the TSA as well. So even in specific, no case addresses a TSA making up the uttering of the word bomb, which is what we allege happened in this case. But there have been cases, including the George case, including the Toby case in the Fourth Circuit. There have been other cases in the context of the TSA where the First Amendment rights and the Bivens protections have extended.
Well, in George, which was this court's case, we said we were assuming it applied. We didn't say we are finding it applied. We went out of our way in a footnote to say, you know, you can look at both sides of this and have a question, but for purposes of our discussion, we accepted for the discussion and assumed that it applied. That wasn't a finding, was it? That wasn't a holding.
I appreciate and respect and give credence to the assumption that this court made because it's based on logic, it's based on common sense, and it's based on decency. I mean, there's not a situation, and it goes, I guess, to the issue as well that they raised in terms of the clearly established right. The case law is clear that there does not have to be some prior precedent that addresses the exact factual situation that Mr. Vanderkuff is in for there to be a clearly established right.
Bivens is an exception to sovereign immunity, right?
Correct.
And the sovereign has now come and said that TSA is so vital, the situation is so sensitive, that we don't want to extend that exception to sovereign immunity to cover it. Now, don't we have to pay some attention to the sovereign when the sovereign says that?
When the sovereign says it while continuing to employ a person that the record, the video, and trial transcripts proves has perjured himself, I think we do have to start questioning whether we should listen to the sovereign when it comes to our constitutional and specifically our First Amendment rights. In this particular instance, Your Honor, there was a trial that took place where Agent Keyser testified that Mr. Vanderkloot did things that the video clearly shows he did not do. And he's still working for the government. He's still dealing with passengers in Philadelphia Airport. Regardless of the proposed law about the bomb, he said he was flailing his arms around. He said he was pointing in his face. And the video shows this man walking through the airport at every moment, and he never did those things. That's something that, if the court starts with the idea of, well, why do you bring a PVC pipe for, I would hope that there's some outrage about a TSA agent who still works for this sovereign government that comes in here and asks to put the First Amendment aside at an airport, a place where almost all of us...
It doesn't have to be an outrage. There's a pending lawsuit against it.
Understood.
That's why we're
Understood.
Here.
Understood. I apologize for raising my voice, Your Honor.
No, that's all right.
But I do take umbrage at the idea that a sovereign at this point saying... It's been assumed at every level by every court, it's been assumed that the Bivens extends to this scenario or this situation or this physical place to come in now when they're on the eve of trial, which is when this was filed about a week before we were going to start picking a jury, and say airports are so special, 9/11 was such a, you know, and fall back on something like that to put Mr. Vanderkuff in the situation that he's in now. I was going to raise the issue of the other remedies and how government at every step of this way of this case has shut down those remedies for Mr. Vanderkuff. This very trial court, Judge Packer, did not cut me off, by the way, at all during argument. He was the person, he was the judge who ruled upon the police officers and took them out of this case based on their probable cause, listening to the alleged lie. He's not a person who ate out of our hands, so to speak, throughout this proceeding. He listened to this case, he listened to arguments, read the case law, and everything that implied, stated, or seemed to say that the Bivens actions apply to TSA and certainly at airports. Look at Bivens itself. This is these are federal agents. Those DEA agents do something that is dangerous. They do carry guns. They do put themselves in harm's way. They knock down doors, not knowing what's on the other side. We can sue them, but we can't sue a TSA agent. It doesn't make sense. There's
if you make a mistake when you're knocking down a door, it doesn't mean that an airliner is going to drop out of the sky with a hole in the side, right?
It could mean that a federal agent loses his life or her life.
It would absolutely be a tragedy, but it wouldn't put hundreds and hundreds of people at risk of death, right?
Understood.
It's a different thing, and I think that's what the United States is pressing on us. It's different.
Understood. And there has never been a finding that TSA agents or TSA officers cannot be in a Bivens litigation or be sued in a Bivens case. So I think that's important, too. Now, I noticed that my time is up. I also noticed that Mr. Aguilar went over the combined time. So I would be happy to answer other questions. I'll just be in the court.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Cannell, rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Cannell, Mr. Malone indicates that Mr. Keiser is still employed in his usual capacity. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm a little surprised to hear counsel say that he now says anyone can call the police. I thought that that was what was being argued, and certainly that was what the district court did find.
Well, you've got it, so run with it. What else do you have in rebuttal?
But the fact of the matter is that loops back into this jurisdictional question, too, because the we had originally opposed or sought dismissal of the malicious prosecution claim of the Fourth Amendment on the merit, not under qualified immunity. Qualified immunity only came in because the district court said, well, wait a minute, doesn't the agent have to have probable cause? Well, if so, that's brand new law. And so then we need to question whether that was a clearly established right that the plaintiff can rely upon. But it only came up at oral argument and subsequently in the judge's decision. So I would commend that to the court for the question of the jurisdictional issue. And I appreciate Your Honor's sort of pressing the margins with the hypothetical of what if you have just a real rogue agent. I would imagine if you had a rogue agent, that person would be working outside the scope of their duties. They would be operating outside the scope of their duties.
The other side has not used the term rogue agent, nor has your opponent used the word liar, but that's effectively the result of what is being suggested. It's being suggested that Agent Keiser lied, that he made something up.
Right. And I would submit to Your Honor that the reason that the TSA took the position that he was still within the scope of his duties was because there was a proper finding of probable cause for the arrest and the prosecution. As this court said in Pritchard,
the finding of probable cause was based on the alleged lie. I mean, you can't run in that circle very comfortably, can you? I mean, you can't say there was probable cause, and what was the probable cause? It was the lie, so you can't look at the lie because there was probable cause. That doesn't wash.
And that was exactly the position that the district court took, that it was solely based upon the false statement of Mr. Keiser. That's not so. What happened was there was a detective brought in to investigate. There were interviews of both the agent and the plaintiff. There was an inspection of his bags. There was a consultation with the prosecutor. There was, in other words, a third independent party.
But the predicate to it all was a report to the police, and that report and that call included the statement allegedly made by Mr. Vanderklok.
That's right. And that one call does not initiate a criminal prosecution, nor does a single false statement that's sufficient alone to sustain a malicious prosecution claim, as this court said in the Pritchard case. In fact, Reschel, the U.S. Supreme Court, said it is not clearly established that an arrest with probable cause will give rise to a First Amendment violation. And that's exactly consistent with this court's ruling in the George case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cannell.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Aguilar, Mr. Malone, a well-argued case, a very important and a very difficult case. We thank all of you. And with that said, we'll ask the clerk to adjourn the proceedings.